I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. John Eisenberg's latest book profiles the five men who took a chance on professional football in the 1920s, competing fiercely with each other, but also cooperating strategically in the service of growing their nation enterprise into a successful business. Today, the NFL generates more than $13 billion a year, but in the early days, its success was by no means a foregone conclusion. The book is called The League. John Eisenberg joins me in Studio A. Plus, Clayton Guyton started the Rose Street Community Center 20 years ago in one of Baltimore's most distressed neighborhoods. He's featured in a new documentary film called Charm City about Baltimore's communities of color, the police, and efforts to end violence. I'll talk with Clayton Guyton and the film's producer, Marilyn Ness. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. The NFL is one of the most successful sports businesses in history, with annual revenues hovering between $13 and $14 billion. It is in many ways an unparalleled juggernaut. But when the NFL's first game was played in Akron, Ohio in 1920, it wasn't nearly as popular as college football. And there were plenty of people who thought that the five owners who formed the league were destined for failure. In his latest book, John Eisenberg chronicles the rivalry and the cooperation between those five owners: Art Rooney, George Halas, Tim Mara, George Preston Marshall, and Burt Bell, that set the stage for the NFL to grow to its gargantuan proportions. John Eisenberg is a columnist for BaltimoreRavens.com and the author of 9 books. His latest is The League: How Five Rivals Created the NFL and Launched a Sports Empire. Welcome back, John. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
And football fans and others, if you'd like to join our conversation, the number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. So, really enjoyed this book. And I want to start with the rules. I was intrigued by finding out that the rules in football in the 20s and 30s were vastly different than they were when I started becoming a football fan in the 60s and 70s. You write that a typical game was no more than a brawl, loosely governed by rules poached directly from college football. So what were the rules in those early days? What were different about it, the game? What was different about the game then than now?
Well, a lot of the differences center on the pass, the forward pass, which if you go back to the 20s was not, there were many, many rules against that sort of kept the forward pass from becoming a larger part of football. Football in the 20s was largely deemed, if you go back to like to the origin of the sport in the 1800s and in the early 1900s, football was thought of as a character building enterprise for young men, you know, high school and college boys. Let's put them out on the gridiron and let's teach them how to be men. Okay, so passing the ball, a lot of it was thought to be let's just butt heads. All right, there was a lot of running the ball. There was not a lot of fancy trickery. None of it. It was just a sludge. You know, they slammed into each other and there were limited substitutions. So the rules, pro football didn't really begin to become more popular until the 30s, when they opened it up to passing the ball. And so there was many changes there.
Because I guess originally you couldn't throw a forward pass. You had to be at least 5 yards behind the line of scrimmage to throw a forward pass.
Yes, and there were numerous other little rules that today are just sound insane. If you're down near the goal line, you throw a pass and it's incomplete and it lands in the end zone, the other team got the ball at the 20. So there was all sorts of reasons not to throw the ball.
Yeah,
so,
and of course the ball itself was a reason not to throw the ball because it doesn't look like what footballs look like now.
No, it was much rounder. It was fat almost, and these guys had a hard time. They just sort of heaved it.
There's a guy named Shorty Ray, Hugh Ray, and he was a sort of rules aficionado, and he helped the owners figure out what they should do to tweak things.
Yes, and in researching this book, I found all of these cult figures in the history of pro football that I was just amazed at. He had a huge impact. No one knows who they are. Shorty Ray was a high school rules aficionado in Chicago. And George Halas of the Bears was like, he looked at a pro game and he said, it was very slapdash. The rules weren't applied equally. Nobody knew what the signals were. And they brought in Hugh Ray, who was a really sharp guy, to sort of bring it up to speed. Let's have the officials signal things clearly. Let's decide lots of things to speed the game up and bring some clarity to all these calls. And over a period of years, he really professionalized the whole idea of officiating in the NFL, which of course is just absolutely central to the whole thing.
Sure. I mean, he organized these groups of people, four at a time. They would go to the games with stopwatches. They would do all this analytics. I mean, it almost sounds like, you know, a precursor of Moneyball, you know, or something like that.
Very much. He would sit there, and if a ball went out of bounds, okay, it was like the stopwatch went on. How long did it take for the ball to get back in bounds and in play? What was the mechanics of that? So the whole idea of what we watch now in football, they sort of took a look at all of it, you know, just the presentation of the game as well as the rules.
Of the 116 official games in 1926, three quarters of them ended without a team ever scoring a point.
Right, and of the two teams.
Yeah,
right.
One of the two teams. And the owners realized that as an entertainment mechanism, this wasn't going to fly.
Yes. George Preston Marshall, he joined the league, actually, in 1932, started the team in Boston. The Redskins started in Boston. And his background was in the theater. He was a failed thespian. That's the best way
Aren't
to describe
it.
Yes. And he had made his money in laundry, the laundry business in Washington. And so he looked at it from a very theatrical perspective. And at one of his first owner's meetings, he said, "Gentlemen, you know, I come from the theater and I know a dud when I see one. And your games are duds. And so we have to make this more exciting." And so that is when the rule changes began. And the forward pass was opened up, and lots of changes began.
Unlimited substitutions, that kind of stuff. College didn't allow that, but the NFL actually did that before colleges did, and it took colleges a while to catch up.
That is just another under-the-radar thing. It actually didn't happen for a couple decades.
Mm-hmm.
After the war, World War II, everybody, college and pro, were having trouble with manpower because most of the players were in the service. So they went to unlimited substitutions. Until then, there were severe substitutions there were limits on substitutions in all aspects of football. It had to do with that character building thing again. And so you stayed on the field. So once everybody was back to speed, the NFL said, you know, this unlimited thing, it's great. It makes for better play. The players aren't as tired. And it led to specialization, which really led to modern football. Suddenly you could have an offense and a defense. And if you had a great quarterback, he didn't have to also play linebacker or whatever it was. He could specialize, he could just focus on his singular talents. So to me, just a huge thing that happened. Pro football looked ahead and saw that worked. College football looked behind and said, we're going to stick with limits on substitutions. And they did it into the 1960s.
Yeah. And in the 20s and 30s, college was the game that people paid attention to. There was all this tradition and pomp and circumstance associated with the college game. And the NFL really seemed like, to most people in those early days, just this like sort of, you know, bad substitute for college football.
Bad substitute and almost unseemly. It was cheap, tawdry, tacky. It was like, to go back again to that character building thing, why would you pay someone to play football? That's not what it's for. And you go back and you do the research and you look at what was going on in the sports society then. All these college coaches were just appalled we're paying people to play football. It's just a terrible idea. And most, a lot of fans agreed with that.
You mentioned George Preston Marshall, the thespian laundromat chain owner who ended up in the league. Let's talk about the other four owners that you chronicle and profile so beautifully here. The first, Art Rooney.
The first Art Rooney, the original Rooney.
And he's called the first Art Rooney because his grandson, I guess.
Well, right? No, the first Art Rooney was the second Art Rooney is the one that owned the Steelers eventually. The first Art Rooney, we're going back. These are all sons of immigrants, these men. And so it really is an immigrant tale. It's a tale of, to me, of 20th century America, you know, guys without a lot of money, sort of, and just an idea. I mean, how many examples of that did we see in 20th century America? These guys are just another example. Art Rooney in Pittsburgh. Never worked a day in his life, came out of a steelworking family, and he made his money by going to the racetrack and betting on the horse. He was really good at it, and I mean really good at it. He was probably the best gambler in America, and he made a fortune. He made a life's fortune at the racetrack, and this is the man who started the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Yeah, and he's not the only original owner who was pretty good at gambling, too. George Halas, of course, legendary name with the Chicago Bears. I love how the Bears got their name.
Well, the Bears got their name. I mean, they were the Chicago. They started out in Decatur, Illinois, and they were a corporate team. And Halas, the corporation folded the team, and Halas took it, moved it to Chicago, and he was a Chicago Cubs fan. He grew up a Cubs fan, and so he moved it to Chicago in 1921, and he said, well, you know, if Cubs are tough, you know, and football players are bigger, they must be Bears.
That's right, because they're bigger than baseball players.
And the team colors are from the University of Illinois, where he went. And it's all these sort of little things, little happenstance things. I think he thought about it for about 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And here we are a century later.
And you mentioned this corporate teams. I mean, so before there was this league or even concurrently for a little while, there were companies that had football teams. Again, is this part of the character building thing?
Well, yes. The Bears actually started A.E. Staley Manufacturing Company in Decatur, Illinois. In 90, they had a baseball team. There was no pro football. I mean, there was just after college, there was nothing. And so it was just sandlot ball. And so these companies would start teams and they would recruit players, and these industrial leagues developed. And this is what pro football came out of, these industrial leagues. So Staley Manufacturing started a team. They hired George Halas to coach the team. And then after one, they moved him to Decatur. And then after 1 year, A.E. Staley said, I'm done with this. It's too expensive. You do what you want with it, basically. And he moved him to Chicago, and that's where the Bears were born.
Another one of the owners, Tim, is it Mara?
Mara.
So Tim Mara. And you say that of the five original guys, he was probably the least likely to be an owner of a football team.
Yes, he was a horse racing bookmaker. He was a legal bookmaker. Before, if you go to the racetrack in today, you bet with the track, right? I mean, all the odds are on the board, and you bet, you put your bets in the window. Back then, before there was that type of wagering, you bet with a bookie on the premises. And there was just a whole corridor of them, and he was one of them. He was probably the best. And so in the New York area, he just was a bookie. He wasn't a gambler. He was a bookie, and that's how he made his money. He had no interest in football, none.
Yeah, he never even watched college football. He didn't know anything about it.
Didn't know anything about it. He stumbled into a meeting. They were trying to get a team going in New York, and the league, the NFL, was trying to get a friend of his to invest. So the friend doesn't want to do it. So Tim Mara stumbles into this meeting, and they say, hey, well, maybe you'll want, you want this franchise? And he goes, what is it? And they said, it's pro football. And he goes, how much does it cost? And they said, oh, $500. So he said, well, okay. And so it sounds like something, $500. I'm a promoter. I'm kind of full of it. You know, I can make anybody buy anything. So he just took a chance that way.
Just jumped right in. And then there's Bert Bell. He had the silver spoon in the mouth at his birth. And how did he get involved?
Bert Bell is actually a huge figure in Baltimore. He's a Philadelphia guy. Bert Bell's the reason the Baltimore Colts came into existence in the 50s. He was the only one of them who came from wealth. He was mainline Philadelphia, very, very wealthy. He blew it all at the racetrack and in the stock market crash and by just being a ne'er-do-well for many years. Then finally he got sober, got married, and got into pro football. He was a college football guy. He got into pro football, started the Eagles, just took it on the chin for years, And ultimately became commissioner of the NFL. And when he was commissioner, he was the guy that really wanted a team in Baltimore.
And at certain points in his life, he's a pretty flamboyant character, right? He was out late. He was chasing the ladies. He was dancing the night away. And
Yeah.
It's an interesting group. I mean, you wouldn't think that those, if those five had sort of, you know, met on a train somewhere, that they would become good friends and business partners. But it's they're all very unique personalities.
Well, they all seem to marry like movie stars and people that were on Broadway. I mean, they were dashing. They were dashing. And yes, that's what I try to do in this book is, I mean, these are famous guys. They're all in the Hall of Fame. What I wanted to explore was the dynamic between them. It was a group effort here. And how did they work together when, in fact, they were trying to beat each other? They were rivals on the field, but they were also partners in the professional football business, and it was a failing enterprise. So how did they do that? How did they take it from just a red ink, fly-by-night thing and eventually set it up to succeed?
Yeah, and although the NFL certainly has more than its share of problems these days, it ain't no failing enterprise at $14 billion a year.
No.
John Eisenberg, his latest book is called The League, How Five Rivals Created the NFL and Launched a Sports Empire. We'll have more with John Eisenberg after a quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. We'll be right back. Here's the Ravens fight song.
You're tuned to Midday with Tom Hall on your public radio. Member supported 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's number one news talk station.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, our series of Conversations with the Candidates continues with Jesse Colvin. He's a Democrat running against Republican incumbent Andy Harris in the 1st Congressional District for Congress. He'll spend the hour with me here in Studio A tomorrow on Midday. Coming up a little later today, the producer and director of a new documentary film called Charm City, Marilyn Ness, joins me to talk about her movie, along with one of the people that she profiles in the film, Clayton Guyton, known as Mr. C. He's the founder of the Rose Street Community Center in East Baltimore. If you just joined us, my guest now is John Eisenberg. We're talking about his latest book, which chronicles the early years of the NFL before it became the multi-billion-dollar behemoth that we've come to know today. The book is called The League, How Five Rivals Created the NFL and Launched a Sports Empire. John will be at the Ivy Bookshop tonight in North Baltimore. If you'd like to join our conversation now, the number is 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and to drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. Let's talk about racial integration of the league. In a lot of ways, ahead of its time compared to Major League Baseball, how did it work? And you write that when the league was integrated, it hardly attracted notice. But of course, with Jackie Robinson integrating Major League Baseball, that was a huge, huge deal.
Well, it's not the shining hour of these gentlemen. Yes, the league in the beginning, the 20s and the early 30s, it was integrated. There are African-American players, several on each team. Most years there were even some stars, and it was just not an issue at the time when baseball was very much segregated, far more popular. No one cared or no one paid attention to pro football then. But when George Preston Marshall, who we talked about earlier, got into the league, he was a son of Dixie. He was descended from Confederate soldiers, Confederate officers, and there was no doubt where he stood on it. And he was a fierce segregationist and just a flat-out racist, one of the all-time racists in sports. And he didn't integrate the Redskins until the early 60s, and it really took the federal government getting after him to do it. So when he got into the league in 1932, by 34, the league was all white. African Americans were gone. And so that was the case through World War II. And so,
The next black player didn't show up until 1945. That's a long stretch.
Yeah. After the war. And what happened was the Rams were in Cleveland, and they moved to Los Angeles, and they were moving into the Los Angeles Coliseum, massive public stadium. And what happened was an African-American sports writer went to the meeting where they were setting it up and said, you can't have a segregated league playing games in this publicly funded stadium. And so they integrated, they realized that was correct, and they integrated the Rams, and that reintegrated the NFL. And very slowly but surely, the NFL was reintegrated in the late 40s and early 50s.
And after the war, professional sports in general had a big renewal, right? I mean, baseball had a big uptick. Football started catching on. Basketball. I mean, it's just sports in general. I mean, the mood of the country post World War II just put it in a place where sports became more central to American life.
Yes, the people had time, things that they hadn't had during the war, which was time and money. They had some money in their pockets, and they had time. And so, yes, there was a little bit of leisure time, and so that's sort of where spectator sports, really people started going. There was attendance spikes in baseball, in football, college football. College football, there was many schools didn't field teams during World War II. They didn't have enough players, so that people were excited to see it back. So, yes, there was just America sort of discovered a love of spectator sports after World War II. But then, of course, television came in around 1950, which changed the dynamic completely.
Yeah, huge. The book is called The League, How Five Rivals Created the NFL and Launched a Sports Empire. John Eisenberg is my guest. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. And John, you know, during the war, you write about how some of the NFL teams didn't have enough players to field teams. And so a few of them merged for a few years. It took a couple of years off and then came back. I mean, it was very shaky during that period.
The NFL barely survived World War II. I think that's safe to say. Unlike baseball, it didn't have the tradition that baseball had. It had been in business about 20 years. A couple of teams were doing pretty well, the New York Giants, the Redskins, the Bears, but not enough to have a league. So a number of teams barely made it. The Steelers merged a couple different years. They merged with the Eagles 1 year, and they merged with the Cardinals 1 year. And so if you go back and look at NFL history, there's all this hilarious stuff that the team was known as Card Pitt. That was very exciting.
There's a seamless merger.
Yes, Card Pitt. And then when it was the Eagles and the Steelers, it was the Steagles.
Of course.
So yes, it was. There were teams merging. The Rams just took a year off. They just bailed for a year, and there were teams folding, and it was the skin of their teeth, I would say, in World War II.
410-662-8780 if you'd like to join our conversation with John Eisenberg. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can also drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. So Burt Bell, the dandy playboy we were talking about, one of the original owners, he proposed an idea that very much revolutionized the game, and that was the notion of a draft.
I would say probably the seminal moment for the NFL. This is in the mid-30s. He had started the Eagles. They were bad. They were getting clobbered every Sunday, and there was players were apportioned was just a complete free-for-all. Whoever had the most, you could just go sign anyone you wanted. There were no rules. There was no anything. So the teams that had money, which was the Giants and the Redskins and the Bears, they went and got all the best players. So Burt Bell was frustrated. He said, I'm never going to get out of this hole. So how can I do that? I can't. People won't come and play for the lousy Philadelphia Eagles. So he proposed a system saying, yeah, how about letting the worst team get the first pick, and then the second team, you know, what it eventually became. And the owners went for it. And it's a key moment, because the guys on top, Mara, Halas, they knew this is going to hurt us. We're not going to dominate like we did probably ever again. It's going to hurt us. It's eventually lead to leveling of the playing field. And so, but they went for it because they realized if we're going to have a league, there has to be competition. You can't know who's going to win. So they said, I totally agree with this. We're going for it. So it began that they would have a draft every year. And of course, these owners, another thing they didn't mind, instead of just having a free-for-all where the owners were bidding against each other, it kept salaries down. And so they didn't mind that part of it either.
Yeah. And one of the owner's sons, I guess, Tim Mara's son, put together, huge research about players who might be available. And Mara insisted that research be shared with everybody else.
Yes. I mean, if you could imagine that today, I mean, these things are guarded like the biggest state secrets you've ever seen in your life. The draft is almost bigger than the Super Bowl for reasons I can't quite figure out, but it's hugely popular. And so it's become a science, millions of dollars, maybe billions, I don't know, put into the science of scouting players and who teams should get. Yes, in the beginning, they just pick names out of a magazine. They just sat there and said, oh, well, I like that guy. My buddy Joe said he's good. That's pretty much what the level of sophistication was. So Wellington Mara, yes, who wound up running the Giants for many years, Tim's son, was one of the early guys as just a kid who said, I'm going to learn about these guys and go talk to their college professors and sort of learn about them. And so yes, it was shared. It had to be shared. No one else was doing it. So the Giants shared their information with everybody.
How about rival leagues? There were several that popped up and then popped right back down pretty soon thereafter. There's one called the AAFC, and that wasn't the only one. I mean, there were other people, despite the NFL's clear problems, there were other people who wanted to get into the business.
More other people saw it as a growth business, especially after World War II. The AAFC, people in Baltimore know there was a team in Baltimore, and it was not a good team in Baltimore, but they had one here. And it was well-funded with people from the oil business and people with some serious money. And the Cleveland Browns came out of that league. The San Francisco 49ers came out of that league. But it challenged the NFL, and it was personal. It was a blood rival, and it lasted 4 years. The problem with the AAFC was there was only one good team, the Cleveland Browns. They barely lost in 4 years. They won every championship. And, of course, they moved into the NFL. They started winning championships, too. They were really good. And so there was no suspense to the league. Going back to that idea of the draft, no competition.
Yeah.
And so the league died. And the NFL annexed them and moved on.
Television, a huge, huge pivot point in the history of this enterprise. George Halas went to a Chicago TV network in 1947. And they agreed to pay $900 a game for the rights to broadcast the Chicago Bears.
Yes, $900. So, yes, I believe the Thursday night package of the NFL just sold a new contract is for $3 billion. So the Thursday night games, which are like the worst games. But anyway, $3 billion. So, yes, that's where it all started, $900 for George Halas. No one had any idea where it was going or what was happening. They knew radio had come along and was successful, and their radio rights, the rights to those games, were beginning to bear fruit to some degree. Nobody had any idea what it would become. And they really fought it in the beginning because they thought the thinking was, if we put these games on this
television,
no one will come.
Right.
And so the Rams, again, who were quite progressive, their owner said, no, it's free advertising, which, of course, was the right way to look at it. And so eventually that mindset took hold.
Because I'm interested, that's 1947. 10 years later, CBS offers $1 million to the NFL, which in 1957 seems like some serious money.
Yeah.
And the owners declined.
The owners declined because as they were figuring out how this TV thing is going to work, some of these teams started regional networks. It was pretty primitive in TV in those days. There was a coaxial cable, and you could say, well, we're going to put this signal in Louisville or, wherever. And the Giants, the Redskins, and the Bears had created networks of affiliates that would show their games on Sundays. And in the case of the Redskins, it was throughout the South 50 or 60 cities, and these were very lucrative for these teams. And so the idea of sharing a network contract, which ultimately happened, they didn't want to do it because they were making big money. The popular teams were making money with their own regional networks that they had created.
Johnny Unitas, if history had turned out a little bit differently, he could have been a Pittsburgh Steeler.
Well, Johnny Unitas is a Pittsburgh guy. He was a Pittsburgh kid, raised there. And, of course, it's a famous story. He tried out for the Steelers, and he never threw a pass in a preseason game. They cut him. And he came to Baltimore, tried out for the Colts, very quickly was a starting quarterback, and then within about 2 years was the best quarterback in the NFL. And so, yes, the Steelers, for fans of the Ravens, and they may want to read this book because the Steelers, of course, are big rivals now and, a very successful, longstanding team. In this book, the first 40 years, the Steelers are pitiful. They are just year after year one of the worst teams in the league. So that is the story of the early Pittsburgh Steelers. It is not a pretty one.
Michael sends an email. I was raised in Washington as a football fan, but I backed off for some years due to the racism of George Preston Marshall. He was the person who insisted that the N-word not be allowed, N-words not be allowed to play in the league. He always used that word when referring to Negroes in public, private, or whatever. He appealed to the South, to which he held broadcast rights. A line in the Washington fight song went "Fight for Old Dixie" instead of "Fight for Old D.C." back in the racist days.
All true. And yes, it was, it's a very, very ugly chapter. And there are, I think, a number of fans in Washington couldn't take that. And it was awful.
Where do things stand with the efforts to have the Washington team change its name?
I think they're at a standstill. I think they've run into, of course, ownership doesn't want to do it. And there have been some legal challenges that don't seem to have gotten. I mean, there's been some. They've had some issues with the patent. I can't remember exactly what the situation is there, but there is no evidence that the name is going to be changed anytime soon.
And speaking of racism, in the early days of the NFL, there's a movement afoot, and it's been, I think, gaining probably a little bit of steam with each passing year since the Colin Kaepernick episode in the NFL. Ralph Moore, a very prominent civil rights activist here in Baltimore, has tried to organize a boycott of the NFL. Don't watch the games. Don't tune in on the radio. Don't go to the stadium because of the racism of Mr. Trump and Mr. Trump's use of this issue and his what most folks understand as a mischaracterization of the motives behind the players who've taken a knee at one time or another over the national anthem. How serious a problem for the NFL is that? Do you think the owners are aware of it, sensitive to it? What's changed now in the last couple of years since Colin Kaepernick did that the first time?
Well, it's an explosive issue, divisive issue. You're correct that it is a mischaracterization of what the whole endeavor, what it was, what Colin was trying to highlight in the beginning. That has been, it's been made into something else, which is unfortunate. I think the owners are aware of it. I think some, it's a team by team basis.
They worried about it?
They're
worried about fans peeling off?
Yes.
If they do one or the other thing?
Yes, they are worried about it.
I haven't been following the NFL all that closely the first few weeks now. Are people still taking a knee? What's going on?
There's been very little of it. I mean, and of course, the NFL has instituted a policy this year, which, I wasn't a huge fan of the policy, but they've instituted it with sort of punishments if you do this or you do that. And so, sort of calling attention to it. It has not been as big a deal this year as it was. Last year was the issue, and there were empty seats at many games. And coming off of last year, the league, I think, was really worried about it. Have we lost fans? What have we done here? What should we do about it? And it's not clear that the steps they've taken are the right steps, but I see it being less of an issue this year.
John Eisenberg. The new book is called The League, How Five Rivals Created the NFL and Launched a Sports Empire. John will be talking about the book tonight at 7 o'clock, the Ivy Bookshop that's up on Falls Road in North Baltimore. And we've got a link to the details about that event at WIPR.org/midday. Congratulations on this book, John. It's a really, really fun read.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, a new documentary film about Baltimore is headed to Baltimore. Charm City opens at the Parkway Theater on Friday. We'll talk to Clayton Guyton, one of the people featured in the film, and Marilyn Ness, the producer and director, when Midday continues after a quick break. Stay with us.